were turning north into Victoria Street, and all around them came the spice from cooking fires, and he saw in the crowds the grim faces of Chinese and Indians and Malays. He could smell hashish and opium, cinnamon and oranges. He felt dizzy with the noise. Squalid figures squatted over cook fires in alleys, stirring pots with weird sticks wrapped in beads and feathers, and half-breed children, half-stunned from the cold, whistled to them from dilapidated courts. Ahead in the darkness, William could see the taller darkness of the viaduct. They passed four gin saloons, each identical to each, where a piano clattered off-key on the boards within, and the stamping and roars of men reached them from out of the smoke. The dazzling brightness of a ragged school, beggar children lounging on its stairs and picking tobacco from their lips and passing a bottle of some black liquor. Fool led him past Quashie's, where a tattooed barker called to passers-by some display of wonder and talent within, and William stared at a monochrome poster of a man in a mask, cutting the throat of a girl. They were seeking a shabby yard known as New Court, and at an arched passageway, Fool pulled them aside out of the crowds. It was quieter there. The passage opened into shadow beside the Royal Sovereign public house, but they did not go down it. After a moment, a Malay sailor stumbled through the front door of the pub and leaned up against one wall in the weak light of the windows, with a hand for balance, and started to piss. The two men watched in silence. He was wearing a Confederate uniform. William grunted.
"Now where do you think he got that from?"
Then the sailor was staggering away from the wall like a man from a losing hand of cards, and pulling at his fly with both fists, and then, without so much as a glance, he went back in.
"The moral few?" Fool murmured. "The moral few."
William laughed, a caustic laugh.
"Four men equal a lion.
How many times did you hear that in a day?"
William regarded Fool in the dimness, trying to make sense of the man.
"Where did you fight at?"
he asked at last.
"I didn't."
Fool shrugged an apologetic half-shrug. "I never saw action. I was stationed with the 5th in Washington as a quartermaster's apprentice in the railway drops. We kept you boys fed."
"We weren't fed. We could have eaten our shoes."
Fool nodded.
"Well, we tried to."
William leveled his gaze and stared down Fool, a man slight, elegant, dapper in his cutaway and starched collar. He did not believe a word the man was saying.
"I, like you, found the war a more complicated thing than most wish it to be,"
Fool said quietly. "It's hard to have faith in our fellows when you see what they're capable of."
"Yes.
I would not relive those days for anything. I still dream of them."
Their breath like smoke in the cold. Frost crept in slow webs over the cobblestones. Beyond was a shabby square of a dozen or so lodging houses, and William could see the stiff grey lines of washing not taken in, a cart upturned on its handles with one wheel pried away. Seated on a sunken stair was a cripple in an old sailor's coat, his crutch crosswise in his lap, head nodding. After a moment, a group of four well-dressed gentlemen emerged from the shadows, smiling dreamily, each to each, and they did not even glance at Fool or William as they slid past. One of them was brushing his fingertips back and forth over the deckled pages of a city guidebook, and William could almost see the black poppy boiling the man's blood.
"Sightseers," Fool murmured contemptuously. "But I expect she's in.
The Lascar's a woman.
Used to be, at least. She's old Latou's widow. Lascar Sal. You've heard of Latou?"
He had not.
"Welcome to Shadwell,"
Fool said. He tapped his walking stick on the bricks of the arch.
"Sal's is the only den left now."
He fixed William with his glowing cat-like stare.
"They say Charles Dickens used to come here."
Just then a tinker burst staggering backward from the door of the Royal Sovereign, his arms wheeling for balance. The man started to laugh in the cut of light cast from the open door, and then he wiped at his face and muttered something in German and went back inside. William watched this in distaste. He said he thought it strange a place like Sal's could exist when the substance could be purchased at any chemist's.
"It's everywhere," he said. "They feed it to teething babies, for God's sake. You can buy it over the counter. Why come here?
Ah, but this is pure,
Fool murmured,
from Canton itself. There's an art to the mixing, I'm told.
An art?
It's like cooking.
William shook his head in disgust.
There's no art to feeding a starving man, he said.
Fool lifted a patched curtain with care and held it for William to pass. In the doorway slouched two men, hands deep in pockets, coats rucked up over their wrists, and they were smiling absently out into the night. They had the leached grey throats of men staring down the grave. The interior was small, perhaps 8 feet by 8, the water-stained ceiling low. William stooped, took off his hat. The Lascar's room was sparse, dim, lit only by a solitary lantern in the far corner, half concealed by a divan where a bundle of wet rags had been thrown and left to dry. He could see a small framed watercolour of what must once have been St. George in the East, hanging now askew on its nail, and there was a low shelf just off the floor near the divan. 5 leather-bound books, with gold Chinese script upon their spines, a polished box of dominoes with dragons carved into its sides, the lid left up, a scale for weighing opium, a 3-legged chair propped against a wall.
Where is she? William said.
There was a doorway at the far end of the room, and Fool was staring into its gloom, as if to discern some shape in the beyond. Then William felt a slow thrum rising from the dirt floor, and the watercolour began to rattle, and the walls were shuddering, and then the full fury of the East London line thundered under their feet and passed. He glanced at Fool, and it was then he saw, under the rags on the broken divan, the tiny, translucent body of Lascar Sal. He had seen many dead in his life, but the hearts of those dead had stopped, and Lascar Sal's beat on. She was skeletal, shriveled. She seemed scarcely able to lift a wrist to wave the two men forward. There was a waxiness to her skin, and her eyes had shrunk to slits, the lashes ringed in a crust of tears. She was breathing fast, labored breaths, and her ribs rose and fell like the shallow ribs of a hurt animal. All this William saw and did not see. She lay with her bird-like ankles crossed, and a heat rising from her skin the two men could have warmed their knuckles by, and her long white throat, with its ropey swallowing, as she smoked her pipe over her lamp.
Sal,
Fool murmured, her eyes unfocused, her face turning.
Dearies,
she said, a whisper like dried leather.
You'll pay up according, dearies, won't you? You'll pay up according.
Fool held out a hand as if to assure her, but he did not touch her, and it hovered over her still form for a long suspended breath.
We're looking for someone, he said. We'll pay for that.
You'll smoke a pipe, won't you, like a good soul, dearies? You'll pity poor Sal?
William could almost not hear, so soft was it.
We're looking for a man named Cooper, Fool said. Goes by the name of the Saracen.
Her eyes closed and her eyes opened. Her lips moved soundlessly. Fool withdrew a shilling from his pocket and held it before her in the low light, and William felt something at his back and turned. The two addicts at the doorway were staring at the coin in Fool's fingers.
No ships. No ships,
she whispered. Fool set the coin with a quiet click down before her, and the Lascar's sinewy white hand very slowly drifted to the coin, slid it scraping across the floor and under the blanket. They waited. She did not stir. Fool glowered at the two men in the doorway, and then he tucked the hem of his coat around his legs and took up his walking stick and shuffled past William into the room beyond. It was smaller than the first, darker, hushed but for the quiet bubbling of the pipes. Against one wall a tattered bed slouched on ancient iron bedposts, 2 figures sprawling out upon it, smoking. 3 others lay huddled in blankets against a wall, and not one stirred as the two men picked their slow way over them, peering into the faces of the dreaming dead. All were men. All were old. Sallow figures sunken in bliss and lost to the world. The skin of each burned with an awful luminosity as if lit by a lantern from within, and when William rolled one onto his side to see his face, The man felt papery and light as a wasp's nest. Fool passed on into the third room, and he followed. A narrow closet, unlit but for the weak light at their backs. He stood pressed close to the small thief, neither man speaking. And it was then they saw, laid out on his ancient back, with his bony hands folded at his chest and his huge eyes shut in their sockets, what was left of the fearsome Saracen. There could be no uncertainty. He was huge, even wasted as he was. An old man, his cheek dried and pulling away from the old wound there, so that the red slash of his mouth could be seen in all its horror. Weird scars curled down across his face and over the ruin of his nose, and the skin there had discolored to the stained brown of old tea, and the scallop of one mangled ear gleamed in the light. He was very near death, William knew.
"It's not him," said Fool.
"It's him."
Fool looked like he was going to speak, but then he did not. William tried to put a hand on his shoulder, but he stepped away like a man avoiding a draft. He was still staring down at the figure in its rags.
"There's nothing for us here, Mr. Fool," William murmured. And then, "Adam."
Fool looked up. His eyes were creased and sad.
"He didn't kill her?"
he said.
"No. Look at him."
William studied the dying man in the bad light.
"I see him," he said.
They made their way back out into the night, and the air felt cold and clean on William's face. He was tired. He glanced sidelong at Fool, knowing it was time the man held up his share of the bargain and told him what he knew about Edward Shade. They did not retrace their steps, but went north, towards Shadwell Station, and Fool took them through a warren of unlit courts and alleys. William struggled to keep his footing, to keep pace. He could feel eyes watching him from the pitch, but shook this feeling off. His Colt was in his coat pocket, the weight of it against his ribs as he went. There were lanterns in some few of the yards as they passed, a smell of livestock.
"Hold up," William hissed. "Mr. Fool."
His fingers moved across the fungal slick of the bricks, and over the sharp lead gutter of a rainspout, or what he trusted must be a rainspout, and then he kicked some clattering twist of metal, and stumbled, and his foot rolled over a soft, cold thing like a dead cat, and caught the ground again, and he righted himself and kept going. Fool was ahead of him now. There was a light. All at once he found himself face to face with a figure in a battered top hat and a patched cloak, and the man was leering a toothless leer. He held in one hand an ancient bull's-eye lantern, its leather strap crossed and double-crossed over his sleeve, like the lashing of a harness. His grizzled jaw, his cheeks pitted from some long-survived smallpox, his one eye turned lifelessly out.
"Pity a poor lad, mister,"
the man whispered. William shook him off.
"Give us a copper for the old missus, just a copper luck."
The man was tugging with strength at William's sleeve, though William was a good head taller.
"Get off," he snapped. "Go."
But as he began to shoulder past, he felt something like the brush of a crow's wing at the back of his neck, and he raised his fingers to the spot, and they came away wet. It was blood. A sudden shadow, a shock of pale hair in the lantern light. He could not say how many there were, only that he fell into the cold muck with his arms cradling his head, as the kicks came sharp and furious at his back and ribs and elbows and hands. There was blood in his eyes. He thought he saw a massive shadow block out the light in the alley, and then there were men lifting into the air like sacks of wheat thrown from a wagon, and that giant silhouette was wading like a reaper through the fury. But then William shut his eyes in pain, and when he opened them it was only Adam Fool, torn and bloodied and quick, his walking stick carving through the four men surrounding him, striking first one and then another with a violent grace, and at each gentle touch from his stick, a froth of blood would explode in the weak light, and the men would clutch their faces and crumple. It could have lasted moments. It could have lasted hours. He could hear Fool breathing in the darkness. The man did not stoop over him, did not offer his hand, but only stood swaying upon his walking stick, and staring wild-eyed around him as if they might return at any moment. William rolled slowly onto his elbows and sat up, and he saw two urchins crouched in the light of an overturned lantern, and when they locked eyes, the small boys vanished.
"Son of a bitch,"
he said. His ribs ached, but he did not think he had broken any bones. There was a wetness at the back of his collar and down his back, and he knew the blood there would ruin his shirt. He pressed a handkerchief to the cut. Fool said nothing.
"You came back."
William fixed on the thief through one swelling eye. He watched Fool shrug.
"Why?"
A long, quiet look. Then the man said, softly,
"I always keep my words, Mr. Pinkerton. I always pay my debts."
But there was a sadness and a disappointment in his voice, and William studied him, thinking of the Saracen and feeling overwhelmed. He asked no more. He had lost his hat, and the shoulder of his Chesterfield was ripped at the seam. His face in the morning would be mottled and lumpen and yellow. He imagined what Shaw would say, and he winced. Fool was coughing with one hand against a brick wall, and the other clutching his ribs, and his feet were straddling some foul muck of the street, and then he straightened and looked at William.
"Four men equal a lion," he said. "Some lion," William said.
Limping, they found a wretched pub next to a butcher's stall with sawdust on its floors and a lantern burning at either end, and there was murder in William's face as they stumbled in. No patron looked twice to see their state. They dragged a table nearer the fire and gestured for a bottle of gin. Fool's hand shook as he poured. The cold bottle, with its paper label in the firelight, the gin glowing like silver nitrate. Fool raised his glass.
"To Jonathan Cooper."
"To Cooper," William muttered. "May he never awake." They drank, poured a second and drank again. Fool held the gin in his mouth and then swallowed.
"It's the not knowing,"
he said after a moment. He looked up, vulnerable, as if something had been peeled away.
"I'd heard rumors about the Saracen. I thought, I don't know, perhaps there might be some truth in them."
William dabbed gingerly at his neck.
"What will you do now?"
"I should ask Charlotte that."
"Ask Charlotte?"
"It's nothing. A joke."
He sipped at his gin and felt a warmth prickle in his throat, and then he blinked heavily and knew he would soon be drunk if he did not slow. Fool was staring at his hands as if deciding something, and then he looked up, his eerie bright eyes shining.
"Do you believe the dead can be reached?"
he asked.
"The dead? No."
"But you do believe in an afterlife?"
William opened his hand and stared at the cross-hatching there in the firelight, and then he said,
"Mr. Fool, I believe the dead live on inside us, in our memories. That is the only afterlife I believe in."
"I was contacted by an old friend yesterday, a spiritualist."
William said nothing.
"You do not approve?"
"I'd never have taken you for a believer."
"A believer?"
Fool said with a bitter laugh. He wet his lips.
"When I was 4 years old, I was visited by two small girls. They would stand at my bedside in silence. They were my sisters."
Fool paused a moment, then said,
"My sisters drowned the year I was born, Mr. Pinkerton. Yesterday, when my friend asked me to a séance, he asked me to bring a companion. I told him it could not be done."
William regarded this man in his grief, and felt something, a sudden anger on his behalf.
"It's natural to want to believe," he said sharply, "but don't let your loss belong to someone else."
Fool's face darkened.
"Did you ever read of the Reno business, back in 68?
William said. "It was in all the papers." When Fool nodded, he went on.
"Well, the next year, after the brothers had all been killed or strung up by the mobs, a rumor started to go around. Their gains from the various holdups were never recovered, and it was said all of it had been buried somewhere near Seymour, Illinois. Scores of treasure hunters turned to mediums to find it from the dead men."
William eyed the smaller man sitting bruised in the shadows, and he felt for his split lip with the tip of his tongue.
"Our general superintendent in New York at the time was contacted by the vice president of the Adams Express Company, one of our important clients. He'd had an intuition, this man said,
that he ought to contact a certain medium about his company's stolen money. He wanted Mr. Bangs, that was our superintendent, to go with him.
I've heard such stories.
Yes. Well, the medium could tell him nothing, of course. When asked where the express company's money was at, a spirit, Sim, one of the dead outlaws, presumably, had only excuses, vague allusions, all unverifiable. He named an accomplice, Sheely. There never was a Sheely with the Renos. Mr. Gaither, that was her client's name, admitted later to us that he didn't even believe in spiritualism.
But he went all the same.
Exactly. Just on the possibility of it.
He knew it was all lies and deceits, and yet he went all the same.
Fool lowered his voice. It's a question of hope, of course. Having that possibility, no matter how unlikely. Living with it. There's hope, and then there's gullibility, Mr. Fool. I'd be sorry to see you taken advantage of. Fool smiled the quick, barbed smile.
It is such a relief to hear you say it.
Say what? My friend asked me to speak with you. You were the last to see her alive. The last to touch her. He believes your presence might make contact possible.
My presence?
At the seance. William stared into his gin. I wasn't the last. You know that.
I would be in your debt, sir.
You already are. Fool raised his eyebrows, his expression faltering. Edward Shade.
Ah.
Fool picked up his glass, set it back down. His face was flushed. What is it? I fear I have misled you, he said. What I told you in the tunnel. William was quiet while the firelight played over the table, the glasses, his bruised knuckles. That would be a shame, he said.
I did not lie to you,
Fool murmured, leaning forward. But I know you are a man of facts, not conjecture. I'll take the conjecture. Some of this is nearer to rumor. William said nothing, waited. I cannot promise it is entirely true, Fool said. That's all I mean. Edward was small, even for his age, and he was always hungry. He would eat anything, just eat and eat, as if he could never get full. Fool regarded William with a cautious gaze, as if weighing his next words. Then he said, Edward loved your father. You knew Shade. A long time ago. He used to say your father was a great man. This was after the war.
Yes, after the war.
Impatience had crept into the man's voice. Edward and I met in New Orleans in 1865. That was a terrible year. The war had stripped the city. I dare say they deserved it. But grift became a way of surviving. Either you were quick or you were dead. Edward was very young, but still he knew how to work a street. I had established an import business there the month the war ended, and I hired Edward to help me with the incoming cargo on the docks. He worked for you. Only briefly. He could not keep out of trouble. I let him go when the customs officials started harassing me. It seems Edward couldn't leave the army supply depots alone. My business had been flagged, as it were. Very troublesome, that. Years later, I saw him near the warehouses in Detroit. I was just passing through. He invited me to an evening at a rat baiting, and it was there I met Charlotte. He wanted to ask which side of the barrier she'd been on, but he did not. I courted her, Fool said. I didn't know then just how involved she was with the criminal element. I loved her from the first. Fool said this and then lowered his face, as if embarrassed. Tell me about Shade. Fool cleared his throat. I met Charlotte again 10 years ago, here in London. It was she who told me what had happened to young Edward. She said your father had been hunting him for years, that they had worked together in the Secret Service during the war. Edward had done something terrible, had run from his post, or leaked secrets, or some such. Your father hunted him relentlessly. In 1873, the boy grew tired of running. He went to your father's mansion in Chicago, to your mansion. He broke in, waited in the dark with a revolver for your father,
A struggle ensued. Edward was shot. Your father dispatched the body. William stared at the small man in the firelight, the mottled bruising along one side of his face.
In 1873, he said. Fool nodded. In 1873, Edward Shade tried to kill my father, in his own home.
Yes.
He was in my father's house, with a loaded gun.
Fool furrowed his brow.
I could be mistaken. Perhaps I am.
William left the unlikeliness alone for a moment and tried to think his way through the account, but it did not make sense.
It would have been self-defense, he said abruptly. An armed intruder in his house. Why would my father not alert the police? Why would he not tell me?
Fool turned his sad, bright eyes on William, shrugged.
How would your Charlotte Records know this? William muttered. Who would she have heard it from? War offenses were forgiven in 66. My father couldn't have prosecuted Sheed even if he wanted to.
Forgiven?
Fool turned the word in his mouth, as if testing the possibility of it.
But who did the forgiving? Not your father, I would wager. Not the men who suffered in the field. Why would my father keep hunting a man he knew was dead? Perhaps to hide the murder?
Fool shook his head.
I really couldn't say.
Tell me something. What was your true interest in Charlotte?
I never had any, William said, distracted. I was only ever interested in Shade.
Fool was quiet a long moment.
What would you have done, had you found him?
William's fingers were still crouched on the rim of his glass. He felt the blood slow in his throat. He looked up.
I guess that's the question, he said tightly.
22. Edward Shade made his first escape before the barge had left the Hudson. It was March 3rd, 1862. In the pre-dawn darkness, the foam in the ship's wake seemed to him to glow with an otherworldly light, and when he turned his face to the wind, a long crack of red light could be seen seeping up out of the east. But the deck he lay crouched on, handcuffed and huddled in a thread-worn blanket, was still black, the boards slick and freezing. Others sat shackled half asleep nearby, and a guard stood in the lee of the wheelhouse with his hands tucked under his armpits for warmth, shoulder turned to the wind. He could hear the low thrump of the engines, the water slapping past. He rose in silence, just levered his elbows onto the railing, hoisted his hips up, and let himself over. He felt nothing. Then his back struck the icy waters and he went under. A sailor leaning out over the stern witnessed his plunge and cried the alarm, and fired a warning shot that went wide, and after a long, slow turning of the barge and the crisscrossing of lamplights across the waves, a lifebuoy was hurled at his head, and he slapped his way to it and struggled to hold on. He was hauled up half-drowned, given a dram of rum, left shivering in his frost-stiffened clothes while a puddle seeped under him on the deck. By the time the sun had risen, he was coughing and could not get warm. His second escape came 1 week later, while trudging through the churned mud of Camp Barry in the gloom of the Capitol's half-built dome. In the wind, its scaffolding would lean and rattle like a broken door, and though he was still weak from his sickness, the sound of it made him bitterly resentful. They were returning from digging a line of fortifications at gunpoint, and were shackled at the ankles, each to each, and he, being the smallest and frailest, walked the rear. He had lifted a key from a guard as he drifted into line, and now as they turned a corner, he bent down at a half-walk and unlocked his chain, and it slithered heavily clear, and he started to run. He made it as far as the rail yard pilings before a shot rang out over his head and he stopped, hands raised high, his eyes fixed on the box cars in the distance. He was stripped and beaten badly for that. Four grown men in outsized boots, kicking and stomping, his spindly child's limbs snapping out, and then curling back in again. They left him crying in the straw, laced with blood, bruised, too broken to tremble. He was but one of 18 in that stockade, and the least vicious of all, but after his second escape he became known as a wily and dangerous convict. He did not care.
He would be damned if he would permit the Union to tear him to pieces. Daily he ate, he dug, he hauled, he slept. Daily he brooded over his escape. Weeks passed. The Peninsula campaign drew nearer. The wheat fields where he and his fellows would be shackled and driven into a grinding hail of shrapnel and bullets. He slept badly. On moonless nights, his death came to him silent and shrouded, and studied him through the bars. He watched the others with hard eyes. He kept his distance. They had come to believe him a bad omen, a boy marked by evil, and though he did not understand this, he was grateful for it. Some of those men were deserters, some thieves. One barrel-chested sergeant had strangled a corporal in a card game. All of them were sly, desperate men. He stole another man's spoon one night, and after the man had been beaten for it, and the stockade overturned in the search, he began to sharpen it, very quietly, muffled by straw. After the second week he became aware of a figure lurking, slyly at the edge of his vision, and he understood his third escape would be his last. That figure was a tall, thin man with a broken nose and a shaggy white beard stained to copper from tobacco, and his eyes were creased to slits, and Edward could not be sure when the man was peering his way. Edward was careful. Edward was patient. He studied the guards' turnovers. He listened through the walls for the crunch of their boots in the gravel as they took the shorter route behind the stockade. He took note of the different mechanism locking the outer door from the inner. He knew the number of paces to the high corner of the camp fence line, and he knew, too, where a washing line of old clothes could be found the second street over. He knew the operations were underway for a major offensive, and that they would be shackled and shipped out soon. He waited for the next new moon, and kept his head clear. In the third week, the old man who had been watching him sidled close. Edward had taken a fistful of rotten rice from the floor, and crawled back to his corner. The old man's two bottom teeth had been knocked loose, and in the gap, his tongue looked grotesquely pink.
"I've been watching you," he whispered, his voice creaking.
Edward sat unmoving, hair long in his eyes.
"I said I've been watching you."
"I heard you." The man wheezed. It might have been a laugh. His knees were folded up near his shoulders, twisted, crab-like.
"I always knew the world would catch up with you."
Edward paused in his chewing, rice clinging to his knuckles. He studied the man's face.
"Do you not know me, boy?"
"I know you, Mr. Fisk," he said. And then Mrs. Shade's trusted servant, broken now, withered, 6 weeks out from his own death on a grassy hillside in Virginia, leaned in close and muttered,
"They know what you are planning, boy. They know."
He had been dreaming about the Saracen. He heard his door creak in the morning cold, and he rolled stiffly onto one elbow and cracked an eyelid, and watched Flood hesitate with his hand on the latch of the door.
"Mr. Edom," the giant murmured, "you're awake?"
"No." The giant wiped his hands front and back on his shirt front, and stepped through into the gloom, and crossed the room with very small, slow steps.
"Give us a look at them ribs," he said.
When he sat on the edge of the mattress, the bed buckled under his weight, and Fool slid against the big man's sloping thighs. He scowled, shut his eye. He could hear, through the open door, Molly, two floors above, hollering down some curse about hot water and towels. After a moment, Mrs. Sykes's voice rose from the depths of the emporium, muffled and fierce, as if from the bowels of a ship, but he could not make out her reply. There was a thump above his head, and then a second thump, and the door juddered on its hinges, and then there was silence.
"Are they been at it all morning?" Flood said. "I just come in here to hide."
Fool groaned. Flood was quiet in the grey light. After a time he rose from where he sat on the corner of the bed, and he drew back the curtains on a grim, drizzling morning. The pane was streaked and filthy. Fool said,
"That was you in the alley. Last night. Dealing down those footpads. That was you."
"So my fists tell me," Flood said,
curling his blotched hands, spider-like, open and shut in the grimy light of the window.
"He He didn't see nothing. You're Mr. Pinkerton. Fool coughed, and as he did so, he felt the bruises along his left ribs come alive. Flood frowned. You always was contrary, Mr. Adam. You sure he ain't playing you?
Fool rose clumsily and swung his bare legs out, dangling over the bed, and then he got to his feet with a grimace. The floorboards were freezing. He stood with one hand on the brass bedpost and stooped and cleared his sinuses and raked his fingers through his hair, and they came away black. The night before was coming back to him, slowly.
You followed me, Japheth, he said.
He met the giant's eye.
Aye.
You likely saved my life.
Flood grinned a sudden, shaggy grin, though the lines of worry did not leave his eyes.
Well, he said, I weren't going to let me boss and saviour get his throat cut now, were I?
Fool stood there with his nightshirt flapping at his knees, legs trembling in the cold. He stared at his white toes gripping the floor.
You follow me again, he said. I'll cut your throat myself.
He felt the blood rising in his skull. It was a hot, dark wrath, and it did not subside all morning. At the open door to his study he found Hetty stooped at an overturned basket of laundry, and he swore to see to it, and in the Emporium office he dismissed Molly for the ragged state of her clothes, and in the dining room he sent his breakfast back uneaten. Later he stood glaring out at the mid-morning street traffic, through the display windows, amid shelves of coral from the South Seas, and Hetty came in to feed the fire, and saw him and withdrew in terror. He felt ashamed, but whatever was in him would not leave him. After a time he sat at the small cutaway and shifted a fossil and wrote out a curt note to Gabriel Utterson, confirming the seance, and then, without further thought, he sealed the note and gave it to Flood for delivery. He did not trust that Pinkerton believed his account of the killing of Edward Shade. That was a part of it, but some other thing would not let him alone. What he had felt, staring down at the Saracen the night before, was the horror of his own future. He had understood that this was the fate of any man strong enough to live out his youth in his world, in their world. He was surprised that he had asked Pinkerton to the seance. What was it Mrs. Sharper had said to Molly that night? The dead do not come back. He was not certain they ever left. The heart is a locked room, he thought, to you as to any. But first there was something he needed to do. After dark had fallen that night, he went back through the filth of Wapping, kicking his way through the trash and rats in the wet. This time he did not knock. He stood listening at Mrs. Sharper's door, and when he did not hear any stirring within, he slipped a slender file into the frame's gap and worked a bent pick into the keyhole, and after a moment the door clicked and creaked inward. He held the handle, listening. Then he slipped through. Sharper's house was silent. He stood in the dim as his eyes adjusted, and then he removed his shoes and set them outside on the step and closed the door. He padded soundlessly in his stocking feet to the room under the stairs. He could hear a raw, unhealthy snoring from within, and when he opened the door, he saw the one-legged doorman, curtains, asleep on a cot, a tattooed forearm dangling, mouth agape. Fool took the man's crutch from where it leaned against the foot of the bedframe, slipped back out. At the drawing-room door he paused, glimpsing the light underneath. He cracked the door an inch. The rose lampshade in the middle of the room was still bright. Fool could see the pianoforte, the draped tables, the utter black of the cold fireplace. But there was no one within, and he set the doorman's wooden crutch just inside the room and closed the door. He went upstairs, testing each riser to avoid creaks, and on the upper landing he went from door to door. Linen closet, water closet, a study, an unused bedchamber filled with old junk. At last he found the sister asleep in a tiny bedroom, the window blocked out, so that the room felt suffused with the horror of her blindness. Fool carefully shut the door. He lifted a tall standing lamp from a pier table and laid it crosswise in front of the sister's door in hazard. At the last door he paused, listening, and heard the slow, muffled sounds of a figure beyond.
He knew this must be Mrs. Sharper. He opened the landing window, balancing in the sudden cold of the sill, then crossed in his stocking feet along the roof tiles to the next window. The sash stood open. He let himself soundlessly in. He saw her at once, readying for bed. She wore a flannel nightgown streaked with brown at the back and had already unscrewed the wooden fingers, and Fool could see the knuckled stumps where she had been carved up. He was thinking of Molly, the sad, still center of her. Mrs. Sharper froze.
"Who's that?"
she hissed.
"Who's there?"
She turned her eyes sightlessly in the gloom, her face upraised, as if scenting the air. Fool stood beside the windowsill, watching.
"I will know you," Mrs. Sharper said softly. "You will rue this trespass."
A long moment passed in the darkness. Her spine was curled, her neck and wrists bone thin. She looked, Fool thought, frail and mean.
"Do you come to harm an old woman?"
she hissed, swift, vicious.
"An old blind woman? Or do you come to rob me? I warn you, there is a man in the house below."
"Mr. Curtains cannot help you," Fool said.
"Who speaks?"
A long, slow, calculating pause.
"You, Mr. Fool."
"You should be more careful."
"Adam Fool,"
she said, her face twisting.
"It has been a long time since a man climbed through my bedroom window."
"Molly's boy, Peter. Tell me what happened to him." Mrs. Sharper raised her face and a dry smile crossed her lips.
"The boy? I do not understand, Mr. Fool. What is he to you?"
Fool withdrew a safety match from his pocket and scraped it alight on the windowsill, and then he crossed the room with the flame bending back towards him, and he crushed it against the blind woman's hand. She shrieked, snapped back in terror, clutching the skin to her mouth. He shook the match into smoke.
"Tell me about the boy," he said again, his voice calm. "We sent him away," she said, "for thieving. I know nothing more than that."
Fool withdrew a second match, struck it alight. A scrape, a hiss of phosphor. The blind woman backed away, bumped up against the dresser.
"That is not the truth," said Fool.
"What happened?"
"He stole nothing," she stuttered. "He didn't steal from us."
"Wait!" "You sent him away for nothing."
"We never sent him away."
Fool stepped closer.
"We never sent him away," she repeated. "He died. He was killed. He was struck down by a carriage in the street and we buried him in St. Aldwyn's. He's dead."
Fool held the smouldering match to her face.
"He's dead." "Dead? Yes."
He was very close to the old woman, and the smoke would be in her nostrils, the heat near her eye. But she did not flinch.
"Why did you lie?"
he said. In the matchlight, her face was etched with a vicious loathing, her milky eyes scooped, unblinking.
"Why?" she murmured. "The poor girl. You took her from the boy, and he was buried 3 days later. When she came back to us, we knew what it was she sought."
"She blamed herself all these years."
"Herself and us."
"Yes."
"But herself less than had we told her the truth, that the boy died going out into the streets to the corner where the two of them used to dip."
Mrs. Sharper glowered with her wispy hair wild and her dry mouth a-tremble.
"We loved that girl, Mr. Fool," she said, "as she loved us. You will not understand it because you do not know what it was between us. We let you have her. Yes, we allowed it because we wished a different life for her."
Fool remembered their vicious covetousness from that time.
"You forget how it was,"
he said. "Don't make yourselves out to be saints. You were well paid for her."
"And what if we were?"
Fool extinguished the match, stepped back out of her reach.
"That isn't love. It's profit."
Mrs. Sharper's face was cast into crags of shadow.
"We must invent our monsters, Mr. Fool, in order to cast ourselves against them. Call us what you will.
But the truth, you are no different than we.
Fool could feel the confusion in his face. He thought of Molly at 6 years old, sliding like smoke through the streets, the steady, sober, concentrated grief that was in her when he first hired her.
You are not her only protector, Mrs. Sharper whispered.
He had held the girl as she screamed and cried and struggled against him, locked in a dream, her tiny body so soft, so thin. He studied Mrs. Sharper's face as if to seek some semblance there of the conflicted heart, but saw only cruelty and the gnarled impress of age. He started to speak, and then he did not, and after a moment he backed through the darkness to the door, his stockings silent on the floorboards. She swung her arms in a slow arc, sensing his withdrawal.
"It was a kindness," she hissed into the shadows. "Do you hear? A kindness."
Fool slipped his shoes on in the cold outside, his stockings wet, his toes numb. He knew Molly would be asleep when he got back. He would go to her in the morning, perhaps, sit at the edge of her mattress, and as she raised her face and stared sleepily at him, he would tell her he had been to see the sisters a last time. He would tell her he had learned the truth about her Peter, and that she deserved to know the facts of it. He would say Sharper had lied, that Peter had found a protector, a ship's carpenter, and had travelled to the continent, and that somewhere in a small mountain village in Austria he was alive and well, and learning an honest trade. She would lie in silence, listening, and he would press his hand into the bedsheets and tell her that there were many kinds of not knowing, and that certainty and conviction were not the same thing. He would tell her he had lived alongside Charlotte's absence a decade now, at least, and had felt her proximity all that time. And when he got up to go, the impress of his hand in the white sheets would remain, fingers splayed, palm open, like a hand extended in offering. Edward would think to himself, years after the war, that there are confluences in a life, moments of deep exchange between strangers, when the strands of two different fates draw together, and the cutting of one necessitates the cutting of another. Such a confluence had come upon him there in Camp Barry in 1862, though he did not know it then. It was the night before the new moon. Three men in frock coats and top hats came brutally in, swinging their lanterns over the faces of the prisoners, and he knew at once that it was himself they sought, that he had been betrayed. The man Fisk clawed through the straw, and withdrew the bent spoon, honed now to a blade, and a stout, bald sergeant seized Edward by the hair, and hauled him sack-like through the gate, outside into the cold. He struggled, kicking, terrified. He understood there would be no trial, and he would that night be tied to a stake in the frozen mud, blindfolded, and shot for treason. As he twisted in their grip, he glanced back and saw Fisk under the high, barred window, a silver outline, eyes hidden in shadow. What came to him then, unbidden, was a memory of Mrs. Shade gliding in a mauve dress among the roses at Shade House. He remembered the pale, languid turning of her parasol, its Japanese design, the sound of bees in the sunshine. He had been, he understood, happy, and had not known such happiness again. He crushed his eyes shut. Her voice was low, kind. Her fingers were long and thin, the joints swollen. He could not recall her face. The men dragged him to a harnessed wagon with a lantern dipping on a cane stalk above the driver, and they hurled him onto the flatbed, and then all three climbed up with him, and the wagon jolted and set off at a fast clip. The men wore their hats low at their eyes, and Edward could see nothing in their faces, and he did not understand where he was being taken. The men swayed and rocked, and he drew his knees up to his chest and eyed the passing streets. They rode out towards the gloom of the city and slowed at the camp guardhouse, but did not stop, and then they were turning along rutted streets and passing abandoned brick houses. No one spoke. At a nondescript house with a single lantern burning weakly above the front door, they got down, and he was taken roughly upstairs to a small sitting room and shoved into an upholstered chair facing an empty desk. It had been a long time since he had sat on something so soft, and his skin recoiled at the brush of it. Only one of the men stayed with him. That man's face was scarred and hard-looking. Edward glanced at the door, glanced at the curtains billowing before an open window. He wondered at the height of the drop, wondered if he could reach the sill without being tackled or shot. The door at the far end of the room opened. A bearded man came through. Black-haired, like the devil, thick and burly, solid through the chest like a cannon, with eyes small and deep-set with malice. He sat at the desk and took a cigar out of a box in front of him and leaned back and glowered. Edward felt a low thrum go through him, a sudden presentiment of danger.
"This is the lad they call Shid," the man said in a deep Scottish burr. He chewed at the end of his cigar. "I understand you've been something of a nuisance in the stockade, escaping and such."
Edward said nothing. He was neither chained nor handcuffed, and he sat with his feet carefully spread and his weight balanced, and he felt the coiled tension in his body. He was careful not to look at the open window.
"You're thinking you can still run,"
the man said. His eyes flicked up, fixed on Edward's.
"You can't."
Edward flushed.
"I understand you've made a skip, something of a career,"
the man continued in his gravelly murmur.
"How many times have you jumped for the bounty?"
"Three."
"Four, sir,"
the man in the top hat who had escorted him in said.
"He has no next of kin, not according to his records, sir."
The bearded man leaned forward, interlacing his thick fingers before him. He had the cigar between his teeth, still unlit, and he said very quietly,
"My name is Major Allen, son. Do you know what it is I do?"
Edward regarded the Major cautiously.
"I offer people with unusual abilities a chance to redeem themselves. I offer them a choice."
"What kind of a choice?" Edward said cautiously.
"Ah."
Major Allen held his cigar out at arm's length, turned it end over end in his fingers, smiled grimly.
"A choice between living and dying. Tell me, do you want to live?"
Did he want to live? Years later he would struggle to understand why he had answered as he had, why he had let himself be spared. The debt would in time come to feel biblical, fated. He had been saved over others by a man who did not officially exist, a thief-taker, the dreaded I, a man who wrapped himself in darkness and walked among the enlisted men a ghost, a rumor, feared and faceless and unseen. In time, Edward would come to love the shifting nature of the man the way he loved the skin of a river. In time, his love would twist and expand into the angry, complicated love of a son for a father he had not ever known. "I want to live," Edward said softly. The Major watched him, wreathed in shadow, nodded. He was the civilian head of the Army of the Potomac's Secret Service, Edward would later learn, a man of unchecked power. His real name was, yes, of course, Pinkerton. Alan Pinkerton. 23. It was the last Tuesday in January, 1885, and William Pinkerton stood in the middle of Gaunt Street, listening to the drift of footsteps in the darkness. The cabman had found the address with difficulty, and he stared now up at the silent house, its weak gas lamps burning a smoky and sinister light. It had been 3 days since he had accompanied Fool down into Shadwell, 3 days since Fool had poured out the last of the gin in that tavern and torn the label from the bottle and scrawled out the address to the seance in pencil on its reverse. William had protested, but the small man had pressed it into his palm, beseeching. The falseness in Fool's account of the killing of Edward Shade had angered him, true. His father had ever been a man of violence, but he had hunted Shade long after that confrontation could have taken place, and if nothing else, this alone proved the lie. William had not come this night because the man Fool had begged him. He had come because something remained unfinished between them. He had come because the man was other than he seemed. A weak fog crawled over the setts in the street. No one had entered or exited the house since the hansom had dropped him. At last, he started across, his ribs still sore, the sticking plaster at the back of his neck, scratching. He knew a man usually suspected his own failings in the men he met. His brother Robert trusted no one on the wrong side of the law, and thought the difference between right and wrong was a clear one. But William knew the law had as much to do with power as rightness. It was built by men for its own purpose, like a steam locomotive, and what was done with it was the work of men who had places to get to and schedules to keep. He thought of Fool. Of course there was a wrong side to the law. He sometimes wondered if there was a right one. If Shade had indeed survived the war, then his father might have found any kind of moment to take justice into his own hands. He knew this. He did not think his father capable of murder, but killing was another matter. William's own ward had lasted a meager 6 months, but had scoured clear any uncomplicated idea of goodness and mercy carried over from his childhood. At 16, he witnessed the worst the world could do to a person, and the sight of that had stayed in him always. It must have been the same for his father. In the early months of the war, before the Peninsula campaign, his father would write him letters from Washington. Curt missives, sent to his dormitory in Notre Dame, with instructions rather than advice. He would sign them under his pseudonym, Major Allen, S.S., of the Potomac. He would explain that the secret to warfare was discipline, that fighting armies rarely engaged, but at the moment of contact, one side invariably broke and ran. "Hold your position, son, and a man will be all right in life as in war. Most bodies pulled off the battlefield are shot through the back." Then in the grim spring of 1862, the character of the war made itself known. William had enlisted by then, was there alongside his father. After Malvern Hill, his father never again made such claims. That was a season of evil unbounded. He thought of the balloonist, Ignatius Spahr, his scarred visage, the anxious twitch of his eyebrow like a wink that made him seem always to be teasing. The look of the man as he ran low into the trees towards the Confederate sharpshooters. That, and that preacher in the burned hamlet in northern Virginia, a rag on a stick, beseeching the retreating soldiers to lay down their arms, waving his arms and hollering from the peaked roof of his church. What was it he had cried? "Repent, boys! Repent, for the wrathful Lord sees all!" He remembered the sound of the rifle. That preacher, when he fell in a slow silence, and landed in the muck with the slap of a wet sack of earth. Eyes rolled up to the sky, arms wide, a burnt hole in his cheek like a kiss. Whoever in that long line of soldiers had shot the man did not stop. William himself had trudged past, staring, too tired to care, and he remembered how no other had fallen out of line to bother with the burying. He rang the bell. A tall, bearded Sikh, with long indigo eyelashes and a red turban, opened the door and let William inside. The house was hushed, cold. He could smell marigolds in the gloom. The Sikh turned wordlessly and moved away with a silent tread in his slippers, and after a moment, William followed, his own footfalls echoing on the inscribed wood floor. It seemed a third walked with them there, and he shivered to feel it. No, he did not believe the dead did speak. He thought spiritualism a refuge for scoundrels and grift. He had known many professional liars in his time, and all had insisted a man must first deceive himself before he can be deceived. The mark, they would grin, must be the most convincing liar of all. The Sikh led him past a lighted room with a fish pond, and through a beaded curtain, and down a second hallway into a parlour. The gas lamps on the walls cast an eerie light, and the air was heavy with incense. William noticed this first, then the gold and red wall hangings with their prints of elephants and tigers. It was a small room, made smaller by the plush, dark armchairs, and the tall row of draped windows. There was a chill in the air. He saw others had already gathered, but he did not see Adam Fool. At the far side of the room, two folding doors of lacquered wood stood wide. A slender woman with long, bare arms and heavy bracelets swayed beside them, and William knew her at once for the medium. She wore a white fabric wrapped around her in some complicated oriental style, and she looked, in the dim light, very still and very beautiful, like a naiad carved from marble. He watched her turn slowly between the two men with whom she spoke, and her eyes, he saw, were outlined in black pencil, and her lips were very red, and he felt something quicken inside him. Just behind her in the open doorway stood a plump man, straining at his waistcoat, smoking soberly. Every so often, this man would touch her arm and murmur into her ear, and she would nod without looking his way. William felt a presence at his elbow and turned. A lady in a green shawl, a scarlet bustle, mother of pearl buttons. She had a thin cat-like jaw and prominent teeth, and her hazel eyes were large and set wide in her face. Grief had drawn its deep lines like a thumb through soft wax. She greeted William with a quiet smile and held out a gloved hand, and he looked at it, and then he shook it. She told him she had come to communicate with her daughter. She smiled as she said this. Her daughter had sickened 4 years ago at the age of 11 and had passed over within a fortnight. She followed his gaze across to an ancient man in a tall, worn silk hat, seated alone in a corner, and she told him that gentleman's name was Gables.
"His son was lost in the Crimea, poor man," she said. "Oh, but he's been to so many of these sittings. Miss Utterson gets excellent results."
William furrowed his brow. He had shifted his stance so that he could see the door over the lady's head, but Adam Fool did not appear.
"You must be a pugilist, sir," she said.
"I beg your pardon."
She touched a finger to her face.
"Your bruises."
William smiled vaguely.
"No," he said, "an accident."
"An accident, yes,"
she was nodding.
"Yes."
She stared up at him, and there was burning in her face a kind of beatitude that left William moved. She looked tired and happy.
"We must be careful," she said, "in this world, at least. Our flesh is so fragile, though our spirits endure. Of course, Miss Utterson does not always reach through, but that is how one knows it is real, you see. It is rather crowded on the other side. There is so much noise."
"Noise?"
"Interference."
She paused.
"Are you not a believer, sir?"
"Well..."
"It is quite all right. I shall tell you what to do."
She patted his arm quickly, and she smiled and smiled.
"You must reveal nothing to her," she whispered. "You must give her no details. Then you will see. She will know things she cannot possibly know. And then you will believe."
He could still see no sign of Fool. He watched the medium glide from guest to guest, and then turn with a sinuous grace towards them and drift across the soft blue carpet, with her eyes fixed on the lady in the green shawl.
"Miss Utterson,"
the lady said warmly,
"how do you feel tonight? Shall we have success?"
The medium grasped the lady's outstretched hands and peered into her eyes as if seeking some answer, but she did not reply. Then she turned and lifted her face and regarded William where he loomed, and she said, in a throaty murmur,
"You must be Mr. Pinkerton."
She spread, then clasped her jeweled hands, and her bracelets rattled, and William inclined his head. He was going to ask her if her spirits had told her that, but he sucked at his teeth and did not say it.
"You have been to India," he said instead.
She smiled, the webbed lines under her eyes, the loose skin in the hollow of her throat, combed blonde hairs invisible above her lips. She was older than he had thought.
"Oh, India," said the lady in the green shawl. "I've always wanted to experience India." "We are more than just experience,"
the medium said quietly. Her painted eyes were fixed with a luminous intensity on William.
"But we are also what we were. I spent many years in the Raj. It is true. It was difficult to leave it in the end."
"It looks like you brought it back with you."
"The Raj is always with you, once you have become a part of it." "Extraordinary," the lady in the green shawl murmured. "Most extraordinary."
She took no notice of the lady, but began to speak to William of